F1, number 13B.
Now, especially in this point, I have seen through the years how very dangerous this is. I have seen again and again that Christian Scientists who had to deal with somebody who were in difficulty, who were not nice, or who were not stable in character, or this or that, that they would say, well, I have to do that which Jacob did. I have to see him as the Son of God. That's very nice. I don't say one shouldn't. But it depends what one thinks behind it and what one conceives behind it. But what most people do, then they trust everybody and they just give to every rotten man their money because they think, well, he is honest, and as the Son of God, he is honest. And they find out after a few months that they have lost their money too. You see, it's if one doesn't see clearly the difference between a cheater and the Son of God, or a robber and the Son of God, well, then one, if one doesn't see that difference, then one trusts every mortal as the Son of God. Now that you can't do. And that is what Obadiah wants to show. He says, you can't trust Esau. If you have to deal with Esau, then you can only do it by translating that mortal concept. But if you trust Esau by just thinking he is Jacob, then naturally you are being let down by that Esau. So let's be clear, you see, that if we say, well, we must see in each one the Son of God, and that we must accept everyone as the Son of God, well, let's see what that means. That means that we use the law of Obadiah in each case, that we begin to realize what really man is, and that we begin to translate first the false sense of manhood for the true sense of manhood. Or else we rely on something which is not the Son of Man, but which is Esau. And so in our consciousness, we must see that we translate the concept of a mortal into the concept of an immortal. And only that immortal manhood can be trusted, and nothing else. So just be aware of that, how one cannot identify the Esau as the Jacob, that we have to translate the Esau into the Jacob, and only trust the Jacob, and never anything else. Quite on the contrary, that we have to bring down in our consciousness everything which is like Esau in the other. We have to bring it down and not trust it by saying Esau is Jacob. That's not true identification. Can you see the difference? I don't know if I have the ability to show it properly, but by just saying, well, you must see in the other one the Son of God, is usually misunderstood by identifying the Esau with Jacob. That's not true identification, because there's no translation in it. So true identification in the Christ tone means first translation. And then we don't trust insincerity in the other. Then we don't trust the other's unstableness, then we don't trust in the other all the Esau qualities. Then we are aware and we are careful, and we see and we begin to see that only the Jacob can be trusted. So, having shown the necessity really for this reformation of men, and having stated in Obadiah, the purpose of the Christ to reform men. We come now to Jonah and to the prophecy of Jonah. And this prophecy is perhaps that prophet which can be most easily understood. It's such a nice story which one can follow much easier than the symbolism which the other prophets use. And so, you see, Jonah is the only prophet who tells about himself. All the other prophets don't speak about themselves. They speak about the country and the universe and so on. But Jonah is that one prophet who gives a life story of himself. And again we see that he turns around men. You see now the focus, you see the focus in the first triad was on God, on putting God's authority right. And now the second triad actually doesn't leave entirely that first, but just focuses on a different point, namely on men. In Obadiah, on that duplicity in men, and showing that that duplicity in men must be reformed. And now we have again men in the focus, namely the life and character and thinking of a prophet Jonah. And he is showing that he is unwilling to obey the words of God. It's a quite a funny prophet, this one. See, all the other prophets, they say, God says, and that will be done, and here comes a prophet and says, I'm not going to do it. So, apparently there must be something in that very fact, you see, that it turns around the resistance to perform the command of a prophecy. And we can see at once, somehow, that the problem, the specific nomenon of evil that is going to be handled here, is man's unwillingness to accept Obadiah, the transformation, to accept the resistance to accept the transforming and reforming power of the Christ. That we didn't have up to now, that problem. And it is quite a logical problem after Obadiah. Obadiah has stated that God's purpose and God's aim is to reform man and to bring him into line with God. But naturally, the questioner comes up and says, that's all right, but if I don't want it, what happens then? It is that which says to the practitioner, but if the patient doesn't want to respond to it, what then? If there is inward mental resistance in me or in the other one, what then? What has the Christ to say to that? And so, Jonah's prophecy is that which says, well, my job is to show that the Christ, now we come to the 2B, you see, to the 2B, enforces, willy-nilly, enforces the translation of any resistance in men into accepting that he's going to be transformed. And he only goes up to that point. Micah takes it then further and shows how this new acceptance is coming to birth. So, this prophet will give us an example of how the Christ, not only as number two, has the power and the intention to reform men, but as B in the chart, it also shows its relative sense, namely that intention to reform men is irresistible, that it has the power to translate unwillingness to be reformed into the willingness where it is ready to be reformed. And then in Micah the reformation is shown. See, when we end Jonah, we don't find him very much reformed yet. We just find him cornered, that he said, all right, now I have to give it up. See, I have to give up my resistance. Only to that point, you see. We'll see that. I shouldn't take that in advance. Now, what is the illustration? Jonah is also a unique prophet in so far that he is the one that prophesies not for his own country but for a foreign country. That's quite unique. All the other prophets were prophesying to their own country, to Judah or to Israel. And he comes along and he prophesies for a foreign country, which shows that Jonah, though the prophet Jonah lived according to the second book of King, somewhere around the 8th century, that the prophecy must have been written very, very late, perhaps one of the latest, in the 4th or 3rd century before Christ. Namely then, when in the Judaic thought, the point has come where they began to see that God is the God of all nations, and not just on the chosen people of Israel. So it must be, in the chronological sense, a very, very late prophecy. What he is prophesying is therefore against Nineveh. Nineveh, you say Nineveh, is that the right pronunciation? Nineveh was the proud, rich, mighty, strong capital of Assyria. And is being taken here as, so to say, the climax of evil. The climax of all evil. Climax luxury, the climax of brutality, the climax of dictatorship, of vice, and so on. So he takes that symbol in order to show, really, that God's universal sense is here to transform even the highest opposition towards the divine idea, the strongest opposition to the divine idea. That love is even concerned and is able to bring about the reformation, to enforce the reformation of everything that tries to resist God. Jonah is that prophet to which Jesus referred most, I think. He even compares himself somehow with Jonah, that though he says of himself that who is here is greater than Jonah, but he makes comparisons because Jonah has been 3 days in the whale's womb, you say womb, belly, and Jesus also was 3 days and 3 nights in the earth's belly and doomed, and both show a sense of resurrection. Now, what is the story? That story is very well known to you, so I can go through it as quickly as possible. It is also built up in a sequence of what I thought was the seven in the word order, And we just want first to take its symbolism. The first subject shows how there is a command of God to Jonah to handle evil. To handle evil. Arise, he says to Jonah, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it. Says, go and handle every claim of evil. Even if it's a claim of evil, it seems mighty big for you, which seems hardly impossible for you to tackle. How should little Jonah from that countryside in Jerusalem go to this big, big city of millions of inhabitants and say, I come along and I tell you to reform? How is that possible? So Jonah is quite disinclined to do the job and shuns to handle evil. Says the problem is too big for me. I don't want to be in it. I get out of it. But Jonah rose up to flee from Tarshish, from the presence of the Lord. You see, he said, I go out of that picture. I don't want to be in it. I flee from the presence of the Lord. I don't want to handle it with God. It's our disinclination to do what God tells us to do because of fear. And so Jonah went down to Joppa, paid the fare for the ship, and went away from the presence of the Lord. The moment he could go out on the sea, he was no more in Israel, and according to the Israelitish thought, he was no more in the realm of Jehovah, and therefore right out of it. And so he begins to learn his lesson, and so to go with them unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. That's all what he was concerned with. Always in that first subject he says, I don't want to do what God tells me to do. I go away from the presence of the Lord. I'm not going to start to handle it with mind. Well, what happens if we don't want to handle a situation? Well, we always know if we run away from error, error runs after us and the situation is worse than before. And that's what he experiences in the second subject. He experiences it that if we don't want to handle error, that then error handles us, that evil is just let loose on us, that we come into a crisis and into a chemicalization. And that is what happened. A storm was let loose. See, we think if we get out of the away from the problem, around the problem, that solves it. And then we find out that it doesn't solve anything, but that it makes it worse. So, but the Lord sent out a great wind into the sea, and there was a mighty tempest in the sea, and the ship was like to be broken. So we can see how the chemicalization, the counterfeit of spirit, you see, is just taking here the place. And the mariners were afraid and cried every man unto his God. Every one cried to their God. On those ships there may have been all sorts of mariners from Tyrus and from Philistine and from Damascus and I don't know where, and everyone had their own God. But Jonah was gone down into the sides of the ship, and he lay and was fast asleep. He had a jolly good time, you see, getting out of it and saying, now it's your job to do it. And he was fast asleep. And you see, that's what the resistance in us does. What we are going to witness here is just that in us which tries not to tackle a problem, to resist tackling a problem and reform the situation. And so they cast lot to find out whose cause was because this evil has come upon them, and then the lot fell on Jonah. He couldn't get away with it, you see. They found him out, though he was deep down in the boat and had a jolly good snore. What shall we do unto thee, they asked, that the sea may be calm unto us? They found out that because not having the willingness to handle evil, they had the storm, and though they said, well, what can we do about it? And so Jonah comes back to his true self, and he says, well, take me up and cast me forth into the sea. So shall the sea be calm unto you. He begins to realize that his state of mentality was the cause of it, and that the chemicalization could only be dechemicalized through his honesty to see that he should handle the sea, should handle evil. So they took up Jonah and cast him forth into the sea, and the sea ceased from her raging. So in that way, you see, they dechemicalized the condition. And then they said, then the men feared the Lord exceedingly. It had one, that honesty already had one big effect on those heathen, you see, those mariners, that they began to see that there is something true about the Lord of Israel, about the Lord of Jonah. They began to worship the Lord of Israel. You see how he shows, how he begins to show, you see, that in the measure, as we begin to give up the resistance of handling evil, that has a reforming effect on everything around us. Not only on Jonah, but everything around us. It's a universal idea, and this universality of the idea in its reformatory power is shown over and over in Jonah. Now we come to the third subject, where Jonah is in the belly of the fish, as we know, and then it says, now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah, you see, it's again that he says, the Lord has prepared the fish. So in all the prophecies, it's always God is the operating power behind everything. He's the initiative behind everything. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. And in those 3 days, always when we come to the three, then we begin to become clear and clear about things, and so Jonah begins to pray. We have the prayer of soul. Mrs. Eddy speaks about the prayer of soul and not of material sense. And in this prayer of soul, which is a very beautiful prayer, I don't want to take the whole of it because that prayer alone has a wonderful structure, but I don't want to take it just to... All I want to do is just to point out the tone of soul. Then Jonah prayed unto the Lord his God and said, I cried by reason of mine affliction unto the Lord, and he heard me. Again, he shows how affliction, you see, is a means, a divine means of soul, to bring every resistance to a breakdown. And that only through affliction, that in affliction is the only reason where he could see that brings me back to reason again. Then I said, I'm cast out of thy sight. I'm no more identified with you. Yet I will look again towards thy holy temple. He turned. You see how in the prophet corresponding to Jonah is Joel on the horizontal. See, on the horizontal as the transforming power. And in Joel, exactly at the very same place, also in soul, Joel said, and they turned to the Lord. See, always on that point we get the turning. So in the third also Jonah turned again towards the holy temple. And then we get the sense of resurrection. I went down to the bottom of the mountains. The earth with her bars was about me forever. Yet hast thou brought up my life from corruption, O Lord my God. He said he went down, but the Lord took him up. Wonderful sense of resurrection. The moment he turned to the Lord, he could see that the Lord is resurrection and not doom. He begins slowly to realize that the Lord's office is to resurrect and not to destroy. Because he had to learn that, you see. He had to learn that he would have liked to knock Nineveh to pieces. I thought that would be right. And if the Lord says, go to Nineveh and preach there and try to reform them, he said, no, not me. Error must be destroyed. Error must not be transformed. Error must not be... There is no resurrection to solve the problem. Down, down with error. Destroy error. So he must begin to learn this lesson. And then he gives another sense of soul as sacrifice. He says, but I will sacrifice unto thee with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay that I have vowed. He wants to pay the price now. Well, it's quite a wonderful sense in this Jonah sense of the Christ as the Christ, which says you must pay the price for investigating error and you must pay the price for reforming everything. So then after that Jonah is rescued to the dry land. You see the third day of creation. The moment he turned to the Lord, he saw that the Lord is going to resurrect him, but that he has to pay the price for it. But the moment he is willing to pay the price for it and identify himself with what is wrong and identify himself what is right, that brings us on dry ground. And the Lord spake unto the fish, and it vomited out of Jonah. And it vomited out Jonah upon the dry land. And there he was again. See, he wasn't doomed. He was resurrected. Showing that in spite, Jonah wanted to sidestep handling evil, God is much bigger. He says, no, I don't let you sidestep handling your problem. What I can do is if you try to sidestep your problem, I bring you into bigger affliction, I corner you more and more, because that's the law of spirit which says I'm one, you can't choose to have two, and corners him, spirit corners us to the point where at soul we say, all right, I give it up, I turn to the Lord. I start from the right standpoint.